Hello, I'm Bruce Sowry. This is Moolah La, Money Made Simple. Many people may choose to help a family member or loved one with their finances if they're dealing with debt or falling behind. And as money coach Lynette Cox writes, this is especially common for Black Americans for a whole bunch of reasons. This is known as the Black Tax. It is a real demonstration of racial wealth disparity that many Black families face. She's going to talk about this and share her own personal experience. Then having a side gig can be great if you're looking to make a little bit more money. But according to a recent survey from H&R Block, many Canadians are considering taking the risk of not filing their side income when they do their taxes. There can be consequences. We will talk about that with Yannick LeMay from H&R Block Canada. He'll take us through the pros and many, many cons of that. There are no pros. And if you are new to the world of investing, you may experience some challenges. But what if you're new to the world you're living in, aka new Canadians? Even if you know the basics of investing, there are certainly some difference that you need to be aware of if you are newly arrived here. Enoch Omolulu is the founder of Savvy New Canadians, and he's here to talk about what some of those differences are and share investing tips for recent immigrants. Plus, a guide for women building wealth. I'll speak to Hadriana Leo, founder of Money Navigator, about her book, Becoming a Wealthy Woman on Purpose, your guide to creating wealth confidently and unapologetically. I love that. This is Moolah La, Money Made Simple, brought to you in part by Credit Canada, the first and longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency in the country. Let's get started. If someone close to you is in debt, you might want to help them out financially. You might feel obligated to help them out financially. And in some communities, this is much more widespread than others. Money coach Lynette Kalfanikok says it is not uncommon for Black Americans to assist family members who are in need when it comes to money. It's called the Black Tax, which is not a phrase that I had heard. In a personal essay that Lynette published on Vox, she talks about her own experience and also the racial wealth disparity that exists and that she's experienced firsthand. She is the CEO of AskTheMoneyCoach.com. She joins us today from Houston, Texas. Hello there.
Hi there, Bruce. Thank you for having me. It's a great topic. I'm happy to have this conversation.
It is a great topic, but it's not the topic that I thought. When I saw it, I interpreted the phrase Black Tax to mean something different than you defined it in your piece. How do you define it?
So when I talk about the Black Tax, I'm referencing the fact that those of us who are African Americans and who are first in our families to, quote unquote, succeed at some level, often feel a financial pull. And so that level of success might be, I was the first in my family to go to college. I was the first to become a homeowner. I was the first to get a six-figure job. I was the first to achieve a certain amount of savings or net worth. And then when you have that quote unquote success, it's not at all uncommon for family members, you know, siblings, aunts, you know, mom or dad, you know, nephews, nieces, et cetera, who have not frankly achieved the same level of either economic or, you know, kind of socioeconomic status, who have not achieved that same level of success, to have needs and to ask you for things. Mm. It might be cash, it might be loans, it might be they want you to co-sign for something. Now, I really wanna make very, very clear that having quote unquote the Black Tax is not something that is exclusive, or this phenomena as a whole of the pull of those of us who are first in our families. It's not exclusive to Black families. The term originated in South Africa, and it is exclusive to us when we talk about Black people in our lived experiences. But certainly there are people who are Polish, who are German, who are Colombian, who, you know, from all around the world, who also many of my Asian friends and et cetera, experience the same pull to be called upon to support, to give money, et cetera. It's just that when it happens within the African-American community, we call it the Black Tax. And our economic story here in America, obviously, is very different than other groups.
It's interesting that we're having this conversation today because literally last night, I lead a financial coaching program here in Canada, and one of our coaches talked about her culture. She said, where I'm from, you are responsible for your immediate family. You are also responsible for the cousins and the aunties and the uncles. And as someone who was born and raised in my family, has been a white family in Canada, that is just not how our family culture works. And you referenced other groups of people who may have come to Canada or come to the US and they're the first in, but there isn't that cultural context. Why do you think that is so relevant and resonant within the Black community, the cultural side of it? And I'm going to get to the racism side of it too, but the cultural side of that.
Well, I think there are a couple of factors at play. First, I don't want to portray all Black people, all African Americans, certainly, as a monolith.
Yeah.
Because frankly, in my husband's own family, for example, it was not the norm. So he was, you know, pretty much raised an only child. Later, he reconnected with two siblings who were kind of long lost siblings. And his parents and his grandparents, if you asked for money in the family, it was a big no-no. It was, you kind of got your hand slapped there. So it was the family norm was about achievement and success and independence, like doing the right things, managing your money right, and being kind of strong and capable on your own. So this is to say that this is not obviously a universal thing among all Black people. That's the point I want to make.
Yeah.
But part of the why, I think, is that we do have to look at a number of things from a social, cultural, and of course, an economic standpoint, right? So none of us live on an island. None of these things exist on their own. So in many ways, I think some families have a history of either financial dependence or codependence to a certain extent. So it may be that that's the only way that the family survived, right? So you had some families who, you know, whether it was those who were in the South and then one person went, quote unquote, up North, and I'm talking, of course, among African Americans, say generations and or decades ago, maybe an aunt or an uncle came, you know, from, quote unquote, down South to up North. Then came the cousins, then came the siblings. And because they wanted or needed kind of that nucleus of support, that family structure, the economic support, et cetera, you had these relationships that got increasingly financially interwoven. Now, of course, in today's society, you know, we're far flung. I have, you know, two sisters in California. I have two sisters in Georgia. I used to live in New Jersey. I came here to the Houston area in 2019. So we're all over the country. We still provide, you know, love and emotional support and that kind of thing. We're not financially intertwined because we're not either A, all in the same city, or B, living literally under the same roof or in a multi-generational household. But I think that some of those factors actually did play a role in how this has evolved over the years. And then you get to the fact that, frankly, I found, and I just know this as a money coach, in many families, again, not just African-American, obviously all across America, there is a lot of what I call financial dependence and or sometimes financial abuse. Now, don't, you know, fall out of your seat here. Financial abuse happens anytime someone that you know, trust, or love takes economic advantage of you. They might not be intentionally doing it. It may not be like their intent, like, let me try to squeeze something out of you, but they might just know how to push your buttons, or they might know the right things to say to guilt you or to get you to do something financially for them. And I do think that this plays out again in African-American households and elsewhere, where let's say you are the first to have achieved, and then somebody says, I need money for, you know, my mortgage or my rent, or can you help me with this payment, you know, to send my kids to college or whatever. And then if you say no, or if you try to establish barriers or boundaries, some of them, the first question might be, oh, you forgot where you came from.
Right.
Or you're better than us now. Or, oh, you have a degree, or you make this much money, or you live here, and you know, do you remember when we were younger when I did this for you? So it is sort of familial structure, it's history, it's cultural. There's a lot of factors, not to mention, which I'm sure we're going to get to, just structural inequality and the ways in which there's a wage gap, there's an income gap, you know, there's a wealth gap, and there's greater financial need in many African-American households. So they're reaching out for supports that don't exist elsewhere.
You write about your mom. You are one of five kids. I'm one of five kids, but our upbringings were completely different. And your story and her story and her strength as a single mom raising you, it's both inspiring and also just eye-opening, because I don't think that if that's not your lived experience, that you can kind of put yourself into that world in the way that you so eloquently demonstrated. How does this connect to the topic at hand here? And I say, I want to have you bring the anecdote here. It practically felt like you were leaning through the Zoom screen and saying, "Mom, why do you need a sweater? Why would you need a sweater for? I'll just cut you the check so you can have heat that exists at a regular level." Give us the essence of that.
Sure. So, you know, over the course of the pandemic, we started doing a lot more FaceTimes, you know, my mother and I, just for me to see her. She lives in Georgia. And I started to notice, like, she's in her house and she's kind of like bundled up. She was wearing sweaters. And as it turned out, yes, she didn't want to have to pay a higher utility bill. And she didn't, you know, she was cold. And like a lot of seniors who are in retirement, who live on a fixed income, et cetera, she was watching her dollars. And I was like, "Mom, I'll pay for some of this." But she didn't want to have to ask, because she does have a strong sense of independence. And, you know, like a lot of older adults, she doesn't want to have dependency, but she knows that her trajectory and her options and what she experienced were totally different than my generation and my sisters and I, and what we were afforded the opportunity to accomplish professionally, educationally, financially, largely because we stood on her shoulders. Even frankly, both of my parents divorced when I was about 7 years old, but both of my parents really emphasized education. They were like, "Which college will you be attending?" To all of us. It wasn't
not whether you will go, it will be which one.
Which one will you be attending? So we all went to college, you know, and three of my sisters, we got graduate degrees, and the same three of us became business owners. And my dad, you know, again, was the first entrepreneur, frankly, that I ever knew. My dad was a shoeshine man from Harlem. His father was a shoeshine man, and then his father was a shoeshine man. So three generations of Black men who clearly did not have a college education. And didn't even have access to a range of financial boosts, let's call them, that their white counterparts, their white friends, colleagues, et cetera, did have. So when you talk about how this all relates, my mother being a single mom, when my family was in New York, and again, I was born in Manhattan, but I was raised in Southern California in Los Angeles, but I didn't move there until I was, you know, 2 years old onward. But in New York, where my parents met and married, my dad had been in the military. You know, guys came back and had the GI Bill. They were able to get home loans, et cetera. You know, you think about a place like Levittown in New York. It's the first place where the middle class in America was really built here, with all of these homes and subsidized mortgages and insured government loans. But when my dad couldn't get that, even though he did his same military service, et cetera, because there was literally discriminating housing back then. You know, it wasn't until, you know, the 60s, the late 60s, where we started having housing laws to ban redlining and discrimination. But even, you know, codes that were written into the law and deeds that said you cannot sell to a Black person. So my family, they were in New York and then in California. My parents never owned a home. I grew up in two-bedroom apartments my entire life. And again, five girls, picture us being in an apartment, Bruce.
Mom, the two bedrooms, but also the one bathroom must have been a challenge.
All of that. My mom in one bedroom and then five girls in the other bedroom with two sets of bunk beds. So my sister Cheryl on the top of one bunk bed, my sister Debbie on the next one, then my sister Denise, and then me and my sister Hope on the second of the bottom sets of bunk beds. It wasn't until I was in my 20s that I bought my first home after I, you know, went to undergraduate, graduate school, got married, and I lived in Philadelphia at the time, and I bought my first home. Now, fast forward, here we are, you know, I won't say how many years later, but my husband and I, Earl and I, we own seven properties. You know, we use real estate as a wealth building tool. We have amassed a seven-figure net worth. We bought our older two kids their first homes to put them on the pathway to wealth building. So it's definitely a breaking of the cycle, if you will. But I'm very much cognizant of the fact that I'm in the minority. You know, only 45% of African Americans own their own homes versus 75% of white Americans. And that 30 percentage point gap is actually worse than it was 60 years ago when housing discrimination was legal.
We are almost to our time, but I do want to ask you one last question before we go here. Yes. Just connecting back to the Black tax. You've given us a bit of an insight into the multi-generational and systemic barriers that Black Americans, and I'm sure to some extent, or maybe to an equal extent, Black Canadians are dealing with too. What advice do you have to a listener who hears this conversation and has been nodding their head the entire time on how to deal with that in their life in this moment when there are requests that they either can't grant or choose not to grant for whatever reasons? How do they as individuals navigate that for themselves?
So it is a thorny situation to deal with. No doubt it's complex, but I think the central point that I would make is to begin to establish financial boundaries. I actually am a proponent of adults standing on their own two feet and being responsible for themselves, even amid challenging times. Doesn't mean that you can't help. Doesn't mean that you can't support when necessary. But I do think you have to use prudence and to determine, like, how often is this person coming to the well? If you find that they're repeatedly asking you for money, for loans, for cosigning, et cetera, then it's absolutely time to cut the financial apron strings and to start another approach, to talk to them about ways in which they can, within the context of all that they're facing, financially empower themselves through knowledge and education, through tools, through learning how to better manage their finances, et cetera. I don't like to put off on individuals structural things and systemic things that should be solved. Mm-hmm. But there are things, obviously, that each one of us can do within the context of our own lives. And I don't believe in being a financial enabler, because honestly, in the long run, it doesn't do anybody any good. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like teach a man to fish rather than constantly feeding him. And that's kind of the approach and the strategy that I would try.
Even better, teach the woman to fish. That's
teach
even
the woman
better.
To fish.
That's the
go.
Smart. That, then
teach the person.
Handle it out.
The there person. You go. Teach the person the fish.
Lynette, thank you so much for your time. We really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Lynette Colfani Cox is CEO of AskTheMoneyCoach.com. She joined us to talk about the Black tax, as well as many other things connected to the racial wealth disparity that exists in our world today. Coming up next on Moolala, do you declare your side income on your tax returns? Yannick LeMay from H&R Block Canada is here to tell us why that is important. There are consequences if you don't. And later, investing tips for immigrants. Enoch Omalulu, founder of Savvy New Canadians, will be here. If you want to stay up to date on all things Moolala, it's simple to do so. Sign up to our newsletter at moolala.ca. It'll list once a month. It'll list the stuff that I'm doing on CBC Radio and CityLine, BNN Bloomberg, all that stuff. Go to moolala.ca.
Yeah. You're listening to Moolah Law, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Welcome back. Moolah Law, Money Made Simple is brought to you in part by Credit Canada. I am the CEO of the organization, and we are Canada's longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency. Our mission is to help people get out of debt so they can get back into life. Listen, debt is a brutal reality for millions of Canadians. It starts to pile on for lots and lots of different reasons: job loss, divorce, illness, bad luck, you name it. Our accredited credit counselors are available to help you understand your current financial situation and take you through all your options on how to move forward. And there really are options out there. So go to creditcanada.com. We are nonprofit. As I said, the counseling is free and judgment free. People dealing with debt are often looking at every possible way to improve their cash flow. And sure, that is cutting expenses anywhere they can, but it can also include increasing income. And sometimes that is with a side hustle or with some sort of a part-time job. It could be Uber, DoorDash, babysitting, retail, contract work, whatever. But a recent survey from H&R Block found that nearly half of Canadian gig workers are willing to risk not declaring income when they're filing their taxes. Yannick LeMay is the learning program lead and tax specialist at H&R Block Canada. He joins us now to talk about the implications of this strategy. He's in Quebec City. Hello there.
Hi, good afternoon.
Tell us about the findings in your survey. I mean, this was obviously the one that was most surprising to me, that people would be willing to take the risk. What did you take away from the survey?
The main thing I guess we took away from the survey is that there's also a large proportion of the respondents that are not aware of the consequences of not reporting all their income. So that could explain in part why they are willing or thinking, at least considering, not to declare all their income. But the fact is that they're tremendous, very severe consequences for not reporting your income. It could go to, of course, penalties, interest on the amount that you owe, but also it can go up to 50% of the overstated tax and credits that that you avoided by not declaring your income or by making a false statement, false omission. Also, can even go up to criminal charges. So there are definitely severe consequences related to not declaring all your income.
Absolutely. I just want to play that back to you. 50% of, say that again, the deductions, are you saying deductions or credits that they have claimed?
No, it can go up to 50% of the tax that you avoided by not declaring your income.
I see. And so if you avoided $10,000 in tax, you could be there could be a penalty of $5,000, just as an example.
Correct, but it can go more than that, because also by not declaring your income, maybe you are eligible to other credits and other benefits that now, by including your total income, you're no longer eligible to those credits. So we're also going to include 50% of those credits that were overstated in the penalty.
In what circumstances would criminal charges be laid?
It has to be... So there's a different degree in your false omission. So that means you knowingly made a false statement, and it had a significant impact on your tax return. Yeah.
One of the things that people will say is, "Oh, I didn't know." How does the Canada Revenue Agency respond to that particular excuse?
It's our duty as taxpayers to know the law, because it's on our shoulders to declare our income. It's on us to file our taxes with all the correct information. And if we're not aware of what we need to include in our tax return, we need to ask the question. So it's on us. It's on us to do this. So you cannot just say you weren't aware or you didn't know.
How does CRA find out? Because back in the day, if you had babysitting income, it would be really hard to tell that you had that income. Morally, you might feel obligated, but it'd be hard for them to tell. With the gig economy as we know it today, Uber, Airbnb, DoorDash, VRBO, all these places, they track everything. Does the CRA have access to the amount going to an Uber driver? Can they check in that way?
Well, CRA has different ways to audit taxpayers. The first step that we'll see is that they will send a letter to the taxpayer, for example, that has declared Uber income, and then they will ask for the receipts, they will ask for all the paper trail that justifies the income that was included on the return. So that's a first step, and then they will, based on the documents that you provide, they will judge if this makes sense or not, based on your situation. But they have many different techniques. Of course, all of these techniques are not of public knowledge, so they don't tell us all their tricks, but they're definitely well aware of the situations of taxpayers in Canada. Yeah.
I'm a rule follower. I've been filing my income taxes since I was 14, so I can't imagine not doing that, but a lot of people may play a little rough and wild with the rules here. I do want to ask a question in terms of nuance. How would you consider income that you earned from reselling your clothing on Postmark or a website like that? Because it wouldn't occur to me that that would be an income source. It'd be more like, well, I, you know, picked up some money on instead of just donating it to Value Village.
That's a very interesting question. And we get a lot from clients, because nowadays with all the apps out there, it's easier than ever to have a gig work or to have a side hustle or to make a bit of money out of things that you have at home, for example. It's all about the business intent. So that's the first criteria that we're going to look at. So do you have an intent to make any profit? Have you engaged any expenses to make that profit? Have you bought any material? Have you got any training also to earn that that income? Because someone that is in business willing to make a profit will go through all these, right? So we will have a business plan, we'll have engage any expenses, training, we'll have ask information before getting in business. But usually if it's only a hobby would be less common than a business, right? So this is something you would do once in a while. And frankly, if we go all over your expenses, the price that you bought the clothes, price you're selling the clothes, there's no profit there. So you're not making necessarily this to make any profit, but just as a hobby, for example.
One of the things we highlighted off the top is deductions and credits. And I say this all the time for people who are dealing with debt, is you need to file because it's the law. You need to file because you might be unlocking deductions and credits that could really make a big difference for you, especially if you're lower income or you have kids or whatever. Help me make that case to our listeners that's important.
Absolutely. I repeat that every day during tax season. There are more than 400 credits and deductions available to Canadians. So, of course, by filing your tax return, you can claim those credits, those deductions on your tax return. But there's also plenty of credits and benefits that are paid to Canadians if you are eligible, simply because you have filed your tax return. So you don't even have to ask for the credit. You don't even have to file a special form for it. You're just going to get it. So that's, for example, the GST credit that is paid to Canadians, also the climate action incentive payment for the residents of certain provinces. So these are benefits that you get simply by filing your tax return.
One of the other hurdles for people on the taxation front is GST. They don't want to fill out the paperwork. It's complicated, et cetera, et cetera. What should people know when they are earning, side hustle or gig economy income? What should they know about GST?
So what's important to keep in mind, and that is true with everything in taxes, is that there's no one size fits all approach. So you cannot ask your neighbor or ask your brother-in-law what he did with his situation and apply it to your situation, because sometimes it's just a little difference that will make a whole difference on your tax return. When it comes to GST, HST, you need to register to a GST account if in the last 12 months you have at least $30,000 in gross sales. So that is before expenses. But when we're talking about 12-month period, we're not talking about a calendar year. So it could be, for example, you had $20,000 of gross income in December, then you have $15,000 of gross income in January. So that means in the last quarter of the previous year and the first quarter of this year, if you put those two quarters together, you have reached that $30,000 threshold. So you need to register to GST. But there's also very common exceptions to this. So some entrepreneurs need to register to GST the first day they start to earn income. And that includes taxi drivers and Uber drivers.
Really important stuff. Yannick, thank you so much for your context and insight on this topic. We really appreciate it.
All right. Thank you.
Yannick LeMay is the Learning Program Lead and Tax Specialist at H&R Block Canada. He joined us today from Quebec City to talk about the many, many reasons why you should file your side hustle or gig economy tax.
Hi, it's me, your debt. Look, we need to talk. This isn't working. The missed payments, the collection calls, and all those sleepless nights. We need nonprofit debt counseling, and I found the perfect place. Credit Canada Debt Solutions. They're non-judgmental, 100% confidential. They'll negotiate with creditors and even stop interest. Don't you want to rebuild your credit? You deserve better.
Break up with debt. Visit creditcanada.com.
Coming up later, I'll speak to Enoch Omalulu from Savvy New Canadians about some of the things that immigrants need to know when investing in Canada for the first time. But first, a guide to help women build wealth. Personal finance coach Hadriana Leo takes us through her book, Becoming a Wealthy Woman on Purpose, your guide to creating wealth confidently and unapologetically. If you have missed an episode of this show, you can head on over to moolala.ca. You can listen to past episodes. You can search by name or topic. You can go to any of the podcast platforms out there as well. Spotify, Stitcher, Amazon Prime, Apple Music, wherever you listen to podcasts, and download the full show. You could also write a review. You could subscribe to the next episode.
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
I think it's fair to say that the genders have different views when it comes to money. There are different challenges, different opportunities, different societal norms. There are differences. So how can women build wealth in a way that meets their needs, their challenges, all that, aren't necessarily being met in the current context for personal finance? Hadriana Leo is a personal finance coach. She is the founder of Money Navigator, and she wrote a book specifically for women called Becoming a Wealthy Woman on Purpose, Your Guide to Creating Wealth Confidently and Unapologetically, which I love. She joins us now from Pickering, Ontario. Hello there.
Hello, Bruce. Nice to be here. And we have so much to talk about in so little time.
So much in so little time, but we have to start with the title. I think I could spend 10 minutes talking to you about the title because there's so much in the title. What does it mean to you to become a wealthy woman?
Yeah, I think it starts with my beautiful take on the definition of wealth. And to me, wealth is wellness. Wealth is wholeness. So anytime I'm doing my journaling, one of my hashtags is healthy, wealthy, whole. To me, that is all encompassing. And being wealthy is being well in a full, all encompassing way. That I can see the world, I can serve the world, and I can still enjoy my life. That's me, wealthy.
So you could take the case then that someone sitting on a seven-figure portfolio, by your definition, is not wealthy.
Could be flat broke, to be honest with you. And yes, that is the truth. It's not all defined by dollars and cents.
Unapologetically features in your book title. What does that mean to you?
It kind of plays to the typical Canadian characteristic where we apologize a lot.
Yeah, but you were also looking at, I was teasing you there. You're also using that word in the context of a book about women and wealth.
Absolutely. It's not only are women constantly apologizing for who they are or for how they see the world, we seem to apologize for even wanting to ask questions and asking to be seen and heard. So I think especially when it pertains to personal finance, money, wealth conversations, we need to step up and say, well, you know what? I'm here and I will be catered to. I will ask my questions and not apologize. I will show up and make some moolah and not apologize for it either.
You have something called the CARE methodology. So clarity, alignment, results, and evolution. What's clarity mean for you in this context?
It's vision. where you want to go, where you are, and where you're coming from. It's really taking a crystal clear approach to where you are in finance. What do you want? And not what someone else says you should want, but what do you actually want? What does it mean to you? And where do you see yourself going? Clarity, crystal clear. Take it from someone who's worn corrective lenses for a long time. It's a big deal.
It's a big deal. Big deal. Okay. So clarity, alignment.
Yeah. It needs to fit. It's not every strategy out there that is going to be the strategy for you. And I find so many women, they want to try crypto, but they're afraid. I'm like, there are so many strategies available and so many different ways that you can interact and still win within personal finances. So how about exploring the one that actually fits you, the one that's going to help you have a nice, comfortable ride along the wealth journey, and it's aligned for you. It can actually be customized to work for you. That's alignment.
Results. I bet your answer is not going to be a simple dollars and cents one here. How do you define results?
Yeah. How could it be dollars and cents when that's not the full measure? Right. So yes, we want to accumulate assets. That would be wonderful. But how are you sleeping while you're doing that? What is it costing you in family time while you're doing that? I think we need to measure the results of our wealth journeys through all of the places where we get to touch and interact with the things that are important to us. So perhaps you are a single woman and you don't have children. So spending time with kids is not a factor in your results. But what is important and what is the cost to you in creating that wealth outcome? We need to be able to measure that and acknowledge there is an actual cost.
Evolution is the E in care. What does that mean for you? I assume you're not talking about Darwin.
Well, yeah, me and Darwin aren't great friends. However, we need to keep looking to the next level. We cannot afford to just sit where we are and think that it's done. There will be a next level of growth in our thinking, in our outcomes, in opportunities that come our way. And we need to evolve as we mature in our wealth journey. We can't stay stuck.
When you think about the Hadriana of, I don't know, the right time horizon, 10 years ago, 20 years ago, and if you were to have given her this book, which of these four things do you think she would have had the hardest time engaging on and transforming in her life?
I'd definitely say alignment. I would certainly say alignment, because there has been significant conflict that I had to resolve along my wealth journey that came from my past that I did not attend to and therefore put me at odds with some of the strategies I wanted to deploy, at least based on how they were presented to me. So alignment would have been quite a journey for me. And to some degree, it still is, depending on the opportunities that show up.
Sure. The book includes journal prompts, which I love. I love a book that I can write in and think about and come back to. Can you give us some examples of those prompts and why you designed your book in that way?
Yes, it's actually being one of the favorites that my readers are really enjoying, these journal prompts. The intention there was to actually give you some time to mull over what you just read and make it practical, make it realistic for you. So one prompt would be, what aspects of your money experience are bringing you joy, peace, and flow? Of course, you can imagine that's part of the alignment section of the book. Another journal prompt would be in our clarity section. What areas of the care methodology do you think you need to focus on the most? And where do you feel strong? And that's one of the areas that I think women need to also acknowledge. We know everything that's wrong, but what about the things that are actually right? You already have some pretty awesome superpowers there for you to use. So where do you feel strong and how can we leverage that?
I want to come back to another word from your title. See, I said I could spend the whole segment talking about the title of your book. Confidently, confidence. So this is something that is spoken about a lot in money in general, but in particular when we look at it through the lens of gender, because there is data that shows that women are less likely, and I'm intentionally not going to use the word confident here, but less likely to ask for a raise, less likely to sometimes ask questions in a meeting with a financial advisor. What is the source of confidence in your view?
Yes, and that comes from when you take the time to get clarity. I like to say to people, there are things I wouldn't ask for myself, but if my child needs it, you bet I'm going after it. Mm. When we have a reason to do what we do, we can confidently step out and do the asking, do the telling, do the, yeah, that's not good enough, go back and come again, without having to second guess ourselves. We need to be confident as women, and we get that confidence when we have a reason that is strong enough, that speaks to our passions, that speaks to our impact, our innate desires. When we find that, confidence is like a no-brainer. Just get out of her way, like move.
Yes. Just before we go, I want to ask you one last question. Almost the end of your book, you have a section called Contentment and Hunger, the Happy Medium. What role does hunger play?
Oh, you got to want it. You absolutely need to want whatever it is you're going after, and not necessarily the dollar value, but the results, the experience, the outcome that you will get from your wealth. You need to salivate for it. In fact, it has to not be optional. And when we take our time to work in the clarity section, we uncover that thing that's just not optional. When we uncover that, the hunger is built, we fuel that fire, and we go after our wealth.
I feel like my computer screen is smoking because I can feel the fire that you are putting off with your extraordinary passion and energy. Hadrianna, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks, Bruce.
Hadrianna Leo is the author of Becoming a Wealthy Woman on Purpose, Your Guide to Creating Wealth Confidently and Unapologetically. Stay with us. Coming up, investing tips for immigrants. Enoch Omolulu, founder of Savvy New Canadians, will be here. Now, I do this show here on SiriusXM. I am also the money columnist for CBC Radio. So every Wednesday, I'm yakking about some topic relevant over the course of the week, relevant to you and to your financial life. So tune in on the afternoon drive shows across Canada.
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
If you're just getting started on your investing journey, it can be a challenge navigating the market, knowing what's right, what's wrong, who to trust, what to know, all that stuff. It can be an even bigger challenge for new immigrants to Canada because there's a lot of stuff that we take for granted that, you know, like a 22-year-old's going to know just by osmosis because they've been here, you know, their whole lives, that someone who is newly arrived may not understand or have been exposed to. Enoch Omolulu is a personal finance expert, the founder of Savvy New Canadians, and someone who knows a lot about all this stuff, both from his website and from his lived experience. He's in Winnipeg, Manitoba today. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce.
Thank you for joining us. I want to see if you can give us some sense for the difference between a Canadian, born, lived here their entire lives, but new to investing, and someone who is new to Canada. Maybe that's a year, maybe it's longer or shorter. What are the differences for those two overly simplified demographic groups?
Yeah, so I think a few things that come to mind when you think about new Canadians who are new to investing in Canada is just the lack of familiarity with Canadian investment accounts. So, for example, I sometimes see newcomers who are starting to invest and they start off with a non-registered account when their TFSA and RRSP accounts remain unused because they are simply unaware of these accounts, or they are not familiar with the tax advantages that they offer. So that's one that actually comes to mind right off the bat.
Yeah. I'm going to dig into that in a second, but are there others that are top of mind for you?
Something else would be just defaulting to the brokerage at the bank where they first opened their bank account, because sometimes these banks offer like newcomer packages, and then you open your bank account, it's easier for you to get a credit card without Canadian credit history. And then when they start thinking about investing, they sometimes by default also go with the brokerage at these banks. And these are not necessarily the best accounts to use when you have a small account, because you're paying trading fees for every trade you're placing if you have a self-directed account. So that is something else I see is people sometimes don't shop around, look for cheaper options to invest. And sometimes by extension, they may default to a high fee mutual fund at the same bank, which is better than not investing at all. Don't get me wrong. Like using a high fee brokerage or high fee mutual fund is much better than not investing at all, but it is not necessarily the most efficient way to invest as a beginner.
I can imagine one of the reasons why this happens is it can be very difficult for a newcomer to determine who to trust. I know just when I moved to the United States, like, I don't know, I spoke the language, the culture was familiar to me, but I didn't know the brands of the financial institutions because they were different and I didn't have a sense for it. Here in Canada, we've got the big banks, we've got credit unions, then we've got a whole bunch of fintech players. What advice would you have to new Canadians on determining the brands or the companies that they could trust that would be outside of the ones that, you know, advertise the most and that may have helped them with a bank account when they arrived here first?
Yeah, I think these days, just by searching for the best investment account, the best no-fee investing apps, just keywords like that, just searching for that, you get tons of resources that give you an overview of what's available. So I guess thinking outside the box and just going outside of what would be considered your comfort zone a bit can help you save on costs over time. Mind you, when people first start off, for example, when they're thinking about opening a bank account, I advise to go with the big banks just because it's easier to get familiarized with the Canadian banking system that way. You can walk into a branch, speak to somebody if you have a pressing issue and not get frustrated over the phone. But once you sort of settle in 6 months, 1 year, it's time to start reaching outside your comfort zone to look at what the options are out there.
Many immigrants come from English-speaking countries. Many immigrants do not come from English-speaking countries, and there is an enormous range in terms of their language skills, in particular, probably those first couple of years. So if we take investing versus all the other banking things like a savings account, but investing, what expectation could a new immigrant have in terms of their ability to be served in their language of choice?
That's interesting because I think I've come across a few online platforms that do offer opportunities to speak to somebody who can speak in your language. So they have like this list of languages that you can potentially get support in. But I've also received lots of complaints from people who are just like, you know what? They told me this is what I thought they were saying, but actually this is what they meant. So there is still that gap when it comes to finding support in your language outside of the English language, especially when it comes to understanding complex matters, which investing is in a large part. So people either misunderstand what is being said, or they think someone is saying something else, and then they do something else, and then there's a complaint that, you know what, I wouldn't have invested in this mutual fund, for example, if I understood that it is meant for this, or it acts this way, or there's this risk to mutual funds, for example. I've had people say, oh, I thought it was risk-free. I thought it was like putting money in a GIC, but it could be just lapses in that understanding when it comes to technical terms, because it's very different when you speak English as a first language or as something you grew up with all of your life, and compared to when it's something you learned as a second language and you're now dealing with specific complex issues.
We started by talking about the different types of accounts that you can use to invest. It could be a non-registered account. It could be a tax-free savings account. It could be an RRSP for folks with kids. It could be an RESP as an example. Take the case that you are talking to a new immigrant who doesn't have a background in those four things as I described. How would you define them for them?
So I would say for the TFSA, this is an account that you can use for investing in several assets and for any purpose. So if you are thinking about investing, say for the short term, you're thinking about investing towards a wedding, for example, in 3-5 years time, or towards some financial goal in 3-5 years time, this is an account you can use. If you're thinking about investing even for retirement, so 10 years, 15 years, 20, 30 years out in the future, you can use a TFSA. It's very versatile. And while you invest, putting funds that are already taxed by the government, any returns you earn will not be taxed. So you're earning tax-free returns for life. Mm. Now compare that to the RRSP, the Registered Retirement Savings Plan. This is designed for retirement planning specifically. So if you're thinking about, oh, I want to save for 3 to 5 years, in 3 to 5 years time, I want to be able to access these funds for something outside of retirement, it's probably not your best bet to start off with. When you think about Registered Retirement Savings Plan, you're thinking retirement, 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 retirement income to complement your government benefits. And then when you think about the RESP is you thinking right into the future for your kids and helping them offset the high cost of education in Canada. So post-secondary education. You want them to take on less student debt. You want to assist them with paying for tuition. The RESP helps you do that. You can invest again across a wide variety of investment assets, and the government helps you with that investment by matching your contributions with 20 cents on every dollar up to a maximum per year. So invest in that, and then when your kids are in post-secondary education, they can withdraw those funds. While they will pay taxes, if at all, it's going to be at their own low tax rates. So this is an account that is really deferring taxes into the future, but they will probably pay little to no taxes at all on it.
And all that to say, I mean, you defined those three accounts very, very clearly. A non-registered account wouldn't come into play until you'd really done some serious investing, or savings at least, and maybe investing inside those three others because of the benefits that you've mentioned. We just got a minute or so to go, but I want to ask you one last question. When we use the phrase new Canadian or immigrant, it encompasses the broadest range of circumstances imaginable, from someone who, you know, is fleeing strife in their home country and arriving with a shirt on their back, to someone who is coming with significant assets that, you know, they arrive as a real player and an ability to buy assets immediately. So really a broad range. What advice would you have for a new immigrant, regardless of those circumstances, in terms of assessing their own practical and psychological tolerance for risk?
Yeah, so I think risk and return relationship is very important to consider when you're investing. One question I would say ask yourself is, how soon do I need these funds? If I need the funds in 6 months' time, 1 year's time, maybe even 2 years' time, you want to keep it in, you want to invest or keep the funds in an asset or in an account that is almost risk-free. So you're thinking savings account, a guaranteed investment certificate account, an account that is not going to lose your principal, essentially. If you're thinking about investing for, say, something that's going to occur in 10 years' time, for example, so your retirement, then you may want to consider taking on some risk so as to potentially increase the returns you generate on that investment. But then you have to ask yourself the question alongside that, which is, if the market tumbles, say 30%, am I comfortable with waiting for the markets to recover, which may take years, it may take months? If you aren't, then the other question to ask yourself is, what is my goal? Do I actually want to grow this amount, or do I want to just protect the principal? Those are questions you're going to ask yourself, and that you would be taking a questionnaire on if you decide to invest at all in the financial market. So to assess your risk tolerance, you're asking yourself, how much risk am I willing to take, in the sense of, if this value drops, can I stomach the loss? Can I wait long enough for these assets to recover? If not, maybe I should be thinking conservatively and keeping my funds in a protected account, insured account, like a savings account.
Very, very helpful context. Enoch, thank you so much for joining us today. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Bruce.
Enoch Omolulu is the founder of Savvy New Canadians. If you haven't checked out this website, you really should, because it's got tons of perspective on personal finance in general, but also answers questions that are specific to folks who have arrived in Canada more recently. That's it for our show today. A thank you to our sponsor, Credit Canada, first and longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency in the country. If you'd like to get in touch with us, very simple to do that. We have an email address, ask@mulala.ca, and we look forward to your comments, to your questions, to your story ideas, all the things that you might want to talk to us about. Just send us an email. You can also subscribe to our newsletter at moolala.ca, and we promise we will never do anything with your data other than send you a newsletter once a month. Subscribe to the podcast on any of the various podcast platforms out there. Please leave us a review. On social media, I am at Bruce Sellery. That's BRUCESELLERY. That's Twitter, Moolala, Bruce Sellery-Moolala on Facebook. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.